So this is lecture 4 of Standard Model and Beyond. Okay, so today, hopefully, we will reach an exciting result, which is the full Standard Model Lagrangian. Well, we'll see. It looks to me like it's possibly a little bit tight, but and I'm living this new, better life, you see, where I stop on time. So the temptation will be strong at the end to push on, but I'm going to resist. So for my money, this is one of the main things that every educated theoretical physicist should learn in grad school, is to make sure they understand the Standard Model well enough that they can write down the Lagrangian and know what they've done in detail. And in particular, definitely for anyone who's working on, let's say, what you might call fundamental physics, it's important to understand this well enough that you can be woken up in your sleep and do it in the middle of the night. And anyway, okay, so we ended last time by, writing down the basic data. So we said there's two, ultimately, from a logical standpoint, there's two steps we need to take, and then we've given all the information we need to do to write down the Standard Model. So step one was we pick the gauge group, and we said we were going to choose it to be SU3 times SU2 times U1. And then step two was to pick the representation, in which the matter fields, the scalar fields and spinner fields, transform. And we summarize that in a table, the all-important table of the Standard Model. Okay, so let's see if I can do this somewhat neatly. Okay, so again, this is the table of how the fields transform under SU3 times SU2 times U1. So again, one way to think about it is that we just have one spinner field, and it just transforms in a very reducible, it's just a spinner field with 48 components, and it transforms in a very reducible representation of this group. And then we have a single scalar field with two components, and it transforms in a certain representation. But it'll be more convenient to break up those fields into their irreducible representations and think of it as a number of different spinner fields. So the spinner fields, again, are there's the left-handed quark doublet, the corresponding right-handed up and right-handed down quark. Those are the quarks. Then there's the corresponding left-handed lepton doublet, and the corresponding right-handed neutrino and right-handed electron. Okay, and again, we said in this traditional Standard Model, this line is not present. So strictly speaking, when we talk about the Standard Model, I won't be including this line. This is just for later use. Okay, great, and we filled in the table already. So the quarks are all triplets under SU3. The leptons are all singlets. Okay, so just a name, these top three guys. The fermionic fields that do transform under SU3, those are quarks. Those are the quark fields. And the rest of the fermion fields, these next three lines, are the leptons. Okay, so all the Standard Model fermions are either quarks or leptons. These are all spinners. But these two guys, the ones with a subscript L, are left-handed spinners. So they transform like the left-handed spinner representation of the Lorentz group. And those guys, for some reason, transform as doublets under SU2. They transform in a two-dimensional representation of SU2. also known as the fundamental representation, whereas the right-handed guys, which transform as the right-handed representation of the spinner representation of the Lorentz group, transform as singlets. Okay, so much for the fermions. So these are now all the, these six lines are all the fermions. What are the bosons in the standard model? Well, so these fermions are all spin 1/2. They, when we ultimately quantize the theory, these will all be spin 1/2 particles, represent spin 1/2 particles. So what else is there? Well, the bosons have some integer spin. There will be the spin 0 particles, and then there will be the spin 1 particles. Well, the spin 1 particles are implicit on the top line here. Okay, so there is a gauge boson corresponding to each of these gauge groups. Remember, we're trying to make a local gauge theory that is invariant under local SU3 transformations, local SU2 transformations, and local U1 transformations. And so corresponding to each of these transformations, we need to add a gauge boson. So the gauge boson corresponding to SU3, let's call that G mu. Okay, it'll be a 3x3 matrix, 3x3 traceless Hermitian matrix above every point in space. I should say it's a four vector of, it also carries this index mu. So if we think of the index mu, it's a four vector, but then each component of the four vector, instead of being a number, is a 3x3 traceless Hermitian matrix, which transforms in the adjoint of SU3, like the gauge fields we were talking about in the previous two lectures. And then there's going to be a gauge field corresponding to SU2. Let's call that W mu for weak. And finally, a gauge field corresponding to U1 here. Let's call that B mu. That's just a matter of convention. I don't know what B stands for. The key point is that B mu is not A mu. A mu is the traditional notation for the photon, which is a different U1, which we'll get to later. Okay. Okay, so those are the spin 1 particles. So we've specified the spin 1 fields in the standard model, the spin 1/2 fields. Now we just have to specify the spin 0 fields. Well, there's only one line for those again. So that's the Higgs doublet. It transforms like a singlet under SU3, in other words, trivially under SU3, no SU3 transformation. But it transforms non-trivially under SU2. It transforms like a doublet. In other words, it transforms in the fundamental representation. And then we have to fill in all of their hypercharges. So they have some hypercharges we'll discuss in a little bit. I'm just going to fill them in for now. Okay, so let's see, what else to say about this while we're at it? So before I leave this table, maybe I'll just say, so my notation will be that the gauge field associated with SU3 is G mu, and an element of SU3 is some 3x3 unitary matrix. I'll denote that by U3. Okay, that's some U3 will be an arbitrary element of this group. In other words, a 3x3 unitary determinant 1 matrix. Similarly, an element of SU2 will be a 2x2 unitary determinant 1 matrix. I'll call that element U2. And then an element of U1 here will be a 1x1 unitary matrix, not necessarily determinant 1. Or in other words, a 1x1 unitary matrix, which isn't determinant 1, that's nothing but a complex phase. That's just a complex number on the unit circle in the complex plane, e to the I alpha. Okay, great. So what is our job now? Well, we now have all of the fields we're supposed to work with. This scalar field, these six spinner fields, and these three vector fields. And now our job is to build up the standard model, to write down the standard model Lagrangian using these fields. And in particular, the rules of the game is that the standard model Lagrangian is just the most general formula, most general expression we can write down built from these fields that satisfies the following four properties. Okay, so first we want it to be Poincaré invariant. Okay, the Poincaré group is the group of space-time transformations that are symmetries of Minkowski space, flat space-time. So in other words, this is basically Lorentz transformations and space-time translations. So we want our Lagrangian to be invariant under those. That's special relativity. But then we also want them to be invariant under our gauge group, SU3 times SU2 times U1. So those are the gauge symmetries. We want it to be Hermitian. We want the action, or the Lagrangian, or the action that we write down to be Hermitian, real valued in classical terms. And then finally, we want it to have, for starters, we're going to write down the most general renormalizable Lagrangian with these properties. So that means that we're going to want every term with mass dimension where the fields in the term have mass dimension less than or equal to 4. Okay, so let's just talk about that last condition for a minute, because it may require some reviewing. Okay, so as I say, we're going to start. Once upon a time, when the standard model was first discovered, people thought that this condition, that the Lagrangian be renormalizable, that you write down only the terms with mass dimension less than or equal to 4, was a fundamental requirement that the Lagrangian should obey. They thought renormalizability was an important part of self-consistency of the theory. Now, as time has gone by, the understanding of why this condition is, the meaning of this condition is different. People now usually think of the standard model as a low energy effective field theory to some higher theory that we don't maybe fully know yet. And then, as we'll discuss later in the course, if you start with some higher theory and then you run it down to low energies, and at low energies, the symmetries that happen to remain are SU3 times SU2 times U1, and the fields that happen to remain light at low energies happen to be this list, which transform according to this table, then the dominant terms, the terms that dominate the physics, are most important when you calculate low energy processes, will be those terms which have mass dimension less than or equal to 4. But either way you look at it, to understand the standard model, the first thing we're going to want to do is only write down the terms that have mass dimension less than or equal to 4. That'll be some nice finite list of terms. And then, according to the modern view, one can then begin writing down the next terms of dimension 5, 6, etc., which are then treated as small perturbations, which will be the predictions for the most important beyond the standard model corrections you might expect. Okay. So let's just recall a little bit of dimensional analysis before we go ahead. So hopefully you've met in your QFT course the dimensions of the fields and how you get them and this dimension less than or equal to 4 condition. But let's just quickly review it. So we are throughout this course working in units where h bar equals c equals 1, and so when you choose your units that way, it means that length and time and mass are no longer independent units. Instead, mass is 1 over length, is 1 over time. And in this course, I'll follow the So we can just choose one. We don't have to give the these separate dimensions for a given thing. We can choose one. And I'll follow the high energy physicist's convention of just giving the mass dimension of different things. Okay, so now the action S, in other words, the integral of the Lagrangian, in these units should be dimensionless. And that's because you know from one way to see that, one way to remember that, is that you know Dirac and Feynman found this way of expressing quantum mechanics where the amplitude to go from some configuration to some other configuration is the sum over all intermediate paths that interpolate between those two configurations, where each path is weighted by e to the I times its action over h bar. And then you sum that over all possible paths. That's the path integral approach to quantum mechanics. But OK, so for this expression to make sense, this is e to the something. That something had better be dimensionless. And so s has to have the same units as h bar. So in other words, in our units, s is dimensionless. And so now this d4x that has units of length to the fourth, or mass to the minus fourth. So in order for this whole expression to be dimensionless, the Lagrangian had better have units of m to the plus fourth. OK, so once we know that, we can work out the dimensions of the fields. Let's first look at a scalar field. So a scalar field, you know it has this familiar kinetic term you hopefully know and love from a previous introduction to field theory. So here we have two derivatives. Each derivative has, we want this whole thing to have dimensions of m to the fourth. Each derivative has units of 1 over length, which is units of mass. So gives us an m to the 1 and an m to the 1. And so in order to get this whole thing to have dimensions of m to the fourth, we want each phi to also have dimensions of m to the 1. Okay. So phi, units of phi are mass to the first power. Okay, what about spinner fields? We have the Dirac Lagrangian, the kinetic term for the. Okay, so again, we want this to have units of m to the fourth, but this guy has units of m to the 1 again, the derivative does. And so now we have two spinner fields. They better both have dimensions of m to the 3 halves, so that the whole thing adds up to 4. Okay, so spinner fields have dimensions of m to the 3 halves. And finally, let's see, I didn't quite leave myself room here, but if we consider the Maxwell Lagrangian or the Yang-Mills Lagrangian, we said that was trace of f mu nu. And if we just think about f mu nu, just focus on the part that's partial mu d nu minus partial nu d mu. So each f has a derivative in a field. And so it's just like this case. You know, we have a derivative. If we just consider the derivative terms here, each term has a derivative, a field, a derivative, a field. So there's two derivatives, just like here, and two fields, just like here. So we're going to reach the same conclusion, which is that a vector field also has mass dimension m to the 1. Okay, and then now when we say, and now the theorem from QFT is that the theory will be renormalizable if every term we write down, if we count up the dimension of the operators in the term. So every term that we write down in the Lagrangian will have dimension m to the fourth. But in general, that term will be, so for example, let's say we had a term like this, and then times another fermion field chi bar chi. Okay, so then by our argument that we just gave, this would have dimensions 3 halves plus 3 halves plus 3 halves plus 3 halves, so that would be 6. An extra bar half. So that would be a dimension 6 term. That would be what I would call a dimension 6 operator. And then to make the whole thing have, to make the actual term in the Lagrangian have dimension 4, we have to make sure to put a coefficient in front, which has some which is some number, coupling constant, let's call say g, which is not an operator, it's just a number, 3 or 5, or but with units, so that this guy has dimensions m to the minus 2, so that when we combine it with the m to the 6 here, we get an overall term in the Lagrangian that is m to the 4. And so the point is, to be renormalizable, we want to consider only the terms that we can write down so that the operator has dimension 4 or less. Or in other words, so that the coefficient that we have to put in front on dimensional grounds has positive mass dimension. So we would, or non-negative mass dimension. So if this guy has dimension 4 or less, this guy has dimension 0 or mass dimension 0 or greater. Okay, so we're going to restrict only to those terms. Okay, so let's do it. So I'm going to proceed in the following order. So I'm going to try to write down the Lagrangian now for the standard model. And ultimately, it'll fit in 4 lines. And we just want to derive the lines one at a time. So I'm going to proceed by writing down the kinetic term for the spin 1, spin 0, and spin 1/2 terms. And then after we do that, we'll think about what we miss. Okay, so how will we write down the kinetic term for the spin 1/2 terms? Well, so we want to write down the kinetic term for our gauge bosons. So remember our story, our general story for Yang-Mills was that we replaced the partial derivative by a covariant derivative, capital D, which was just the partial derivative plus some appropriate gauge field. Okay, but that was back in the simple days when we weren't thinking about our gauge group as a product of different pieces. Now that we have a product, this formula, if you think through the same arguments, you'll see that what you want is the connection, is the covariant derivative now has 3 parts added to it, 1 part for each of the different gauge groups. So we'll have plus I times a coupling constant G3 times the SU3 gauge field plus a coupling constant, plus I times a coupling constant G2 times the SU2 gauge field plus I times the coupling constant G1 times the U1 gauge field. Okay. And remember that in the general case, we had derived this rule that a Yang-Mills gauge field, in order to make this covariant derivative, in order to make this guy transform nicely, d mu goes to u d mu u inverse, we needed a mu to transform as follows. There was a first term which transforms like the adjoint. And then there was a second inhomogeneous term. Okay. And so now, when we generalize, what we'll find by exactly the analogous, the same line of argument, if you go through it with this more general connection and this more general gauge transformation, where now, so you know now, instead of u, or I should say, a given element u, again, is a triplet of elements u1, comma u2, well, in the order that we were used to writing them, u3, comma u2, comma u1. So that's an su3, su2, and u1 element, respectively. So now g the SU3 gauge field, by this same rule, we'll find will transform like in the analogous fashion. So now it'll just transform with a U3, G mu U3 inverse, and then plus I over the coupling constant G3 times partial mu U mu, partial mu U3, U3 inverse. And then the analogous expression for W mu, I don't want to belabor the point, but let me just write this one out in full just to make sure we're on the same page. So this guy would transform like U2 times W mu times U2 inverse, and then plus I over G2, partial mu U2, U2 inverse, and finally, B mu goes to U1, B mu, U1 inverse, plus I over G1, partial mu, U1, U1 inverse. Okay. And then remember that we derived the court, so that's how the gauge fields transform. And remember that in this case, we said, well, this thing isn't a tensor yet, but we can use the Ricci identity to calculate its corresponding curvature. That thing is a tensor. Remember that in the general case, that was given by the Yang-Mills field strength, F mu nu was related to A like so. And so, analogously, we'll have analogous expressions for each of these. According to the SU3 gauge field, G mu with one index, we'll have a corresponding field strength or curvature, which I will denote G mu nu with two indices. Okay, same letter, but now it has two indices. And that will just be given by partial mu G nu minus partial nu G mu plus I G3 times the commutator of G mu with G nu. And then we would have here, again, the same thing. We would have the analogous thing in terms of W mu, in other words, partial mu W nu minus et cetera, plus I G2 commutator W mu W nu, and the corresponding analogous expression for B mu, nu. So the field strength B mu nu, corresponding to this gauge field, would have an analogous expression, but in terms of B mu. And in this case, because it's a U1 gauge field, and so everything commutes, this commutator term will just die and won't be present. Okay. And so, just like in the general case, in the general Yang-Mills case, we derived that F mu nu now does transform like a tensor. It transforms exactly in the adjoint of the gauge group, like this. Similarly, these new field strengths will each transform like tensors with respect to their respective gauge groups, pieces of the gauge group. So this guy will transform like in the adjoint of SU3, so it'll transform like U3 times G mu nu times U3 inverse, and then SU2 field strength, W mu nu, will transform like U2, W mu nu, U2 inverse, and same with B mu nu, the field strength with the U1 field strength B mu nu will transform like U1, B mu nu, U1 inverse. And again, because everything commutes here, U1 will just pass through B mu nu and cancel U1 inverse. And so actually, B mu nu won't transform at all. Okay, great. And so here we said that lets us write down the Yang-Mills field strength in the general case. It's just the sort of generalization of the Maxwell Lagrangian, but with a trace. F mu nu contracted with F mu nu. And then trace over the matrix components we take this n by n matrix, multiply it by this n by n matrix, we get a new n by n matrix, we take its trace, matrix trace. Same goes here. So minus 1/4 trace of G mu nu, G mu nu, or W mu nu, W mu nu, or B mu nu, B mu nu, those will all be invariant, not only under the standard model gauge group, but also under the Lorentz group. So we have the first line in our table here. So we now know how to write down the kinetic terms for the spin one fields, for the gauge bosons, the vector bosons in the theory. Okay, we just have a Yang-Mills kinetic term for each of the three pieces of the gauge group. Okay, and actually, because this is just these things are 3x3 and 2x2 matrices. This is really, again, just a 1x1 gauge field. So I just wrote the trace here for parallelism, but actually there is no trace needed here. Okay, great. So that's line 1 of 4. So maybe this is a reasonable time to take a short break. Any questions so far? Okay, I have I remembered a physics limerick someone told me once. This is probably a famous one, you've probably heard this before. There was a young lady from Bright who traveled much faster than light. She set out one day in a relative way and came back the previous night. Ever heard that one? So I wanted to mention that because that seemed like a good thing to me. I think we should all try to write a better, or someone anyway, not all is maybe too much, but someone with that sort of ambition should write a better physics limerick and recite it during the break at one of the coming classes, and I will try to do the same. Is anyone already dying to do that? It's hard to read whether anyone is actually into that or not, but I'm gonna try. We'll see how it goes. Okay, so great. So what about the next line? Well, that's a good time to talk about, before we write down the kinetic term for the spin zero field, it's a good time to talk about what this covariant derivative means. So maybe I'll just write it down here again. So to rewrite, the covariant derivative for this theory is Okay, but remember, just like all covariant derivatives everywhere, the exact meaning of this expression will depend on this derivative is going to act, this is an operator that acts on some field, and its meaning, the interpretation of this formula will depend on the representation of the field that it acts on. So, if, for example, it acts on our scalar field here, H, well, in other words, these three connections, what will actually appear when we expand the covariant derivative are the appropriate representations of these connections, appropriate to this guy. So according to the table, according to the bottom line of our table, the Higgs field, the Higgs doublet, is actually transforms as a singlet under SU3. Now, a singlet just means a one-dimensional representation, but the only one-dimensional representation of a group is the representation where you map every element of the group to the number one. Okay, that is what we mean by the one-dimensional representation. So it's a trivial representation. Every element of the group just goes to the number one. So in other words, that's just saying that actually, you know, H doesn't transform under SU3. And so this term will not be present. Okay, according to the table, it transforms as a two-dimensional representation of SU2. So this guy will be the two by two representation of the Lie algebra. Okay, so that's of the SU2 Lie algebra. So that'll be those are actually the Pauli spin matrices. We'll come back to that later. I keep writing two indices by accident. And then finally there'll be a contribution from the U1 gauge boson. And now is a good time to introduce a bit of notation here, which is that, so for most of our fields, we said that when they transform under a gauge transformation, they transform in some, if they transform in the R-dimensional representation of the group, that means that they get hit by an R by R matrix here. But in the U1 case, and so different representations correspond to choosing different values of R. So for example, for this guy could transform in SU2, and then if it transformed in the R equals 2-dimensional representation of SU2, well, this would be a 2x2 matrix. If it transformed in the 5x5 representation of SU2, which is another irreducible representation, this would be a 5x5 matrix, et cetera. So different in the Yang-Mills case, in the non-abelian case, different representations are labeled by the sizes of these matrices, usually uniquely. But in the U1 case, well, there we're talking about transforming by a complex phase. But now, what are different representations all about? Well, they're summarized by these charges. So the meaning of the third column and the final column in the table there is that if a field has a U1 charge Q listed in that table, that means that it transforms not like e to the I alpha, but it transforms like e to the I Q alpha. And so then if we went through the same argument as before for how the gauge field looks and transforms, we would, you see, I derived everything before using the expression e to the I alpha, and then to make the Yang-Mills case look as parallel as possible with the U1 case. But actually, by convention, usually people write, and in this course we write the U1 case a little bit differently. If you redo that whole U1 argument we did two lectures ago, but stick a Q in the exponent here, then you'll find that in front of the covariant derivative, in front of the connection term, instead of just writing IG a mu, you would have written IG times the charge here, Q. Okay, so we will do, and then the gauge transformation law in those same conventions doesn't change. Okay, so this actually doesn't change because, let me write more explicitly what I mean, sorry. Also I'll confuse everybody. So if we switch to the notation I just said, then this will become, this final line will be equal to b mu, because the e to the I q will pass through and kill the e to the minus I q, and then plus I over g1, and then partial mu times e to the I q will bring down an I q, e to the I q alpha will bring down an I q partial alpha. And then the e to the I will get killed by the e to the minus I here. So it looks at first glance like we've brought down I times q times partial mu alpha. But also, because we made this replacement here, because we used the replacement that I just covered up, that in the gauge field here, we replaced gi by qgi. It's as if we stuck another q down here, which cancels this one. Okay, so the bottom line is that this transformation, and the i's become minus 1, I squared becomes minus 1. So this transformation law in our convention looks like this. B mu goes to B mu minus 1 over G1 times partial mu of alpha. And at the same time, in the same convention, which, as I say, I'm belaboring because it's the conventional one, and it'll be confusing if I don't say anything about it. In front of the U1 term here, we insert the charge Q. So in particular, the charge Q, if you look at the table, the standard model table, the U1 charge is a half. So we would stick a 1/2 in here. So this would become I over 2 times G1. Okay, so that's what we mean by the covariant derivative of H. And so then to write down the kinetic term for the Higgs field, all we have to do is say, well, remember the kinetic term for a good old scalar field, complex scalar field before we gauged was like this. And so that will just become, all we have to do is replace partial by covariant derivative to get the correct term. So there we go. That's the kinetic term for the scalar field in the standard model. Okay. So let's do the fermions now. Fermions are a bit more interesting. Well, let me just say a little bit more here. Okay, so again, what we wanted was for this thing to be invariant under Lorentz transformations and under gauge transformations. Okay, so it's invariant under Lorentz transformations because we had two Lorentz indices here, but we've got them both contracted up nicely. So, like you know from your standard from your GR course or from special relativity course, you know, a thing with a Lorentz index up brings a Lorentz transformation, is hit by a Lorentz transformation, lambda. A thing with an index down is hit by lambda transpose, or in other words, lambda inverse. So those cancel. So this thing is invariant under Lorentz transformations.
Sorry, is there a dagger?
Oh, yes, thank you very much. Yes, there is a dagger. So this thing is invariant under Lorentz transformations. What about gauge transformations? Well, under SU3, we said this term doesn't transform, and neither does this one, so nothing happens. What about SU2? Well, H is a doublet under SU2, so it transforms like H goes to U2H. D mu has precisely been designed to preserve that property, so D mu also transforms like D mu H goes to U2 D mu H, where again, U2 is a 2 by 2 representation of SU2, which is just the fundamental representation of SU2, because that's a 2. Okay, but now we're just taking this object and hitting it with its dagger. So, you know, if we now put the dagger over here and ask how that would transform. Well, the dagger would transform like the dagger of the expression we just wrote down. So d mu h, this would go to u d mu h all dagger, but then using the rule for splitting out a product, that becomes d mu h dagger times u2 dagger That's how this term transforms. And then we have this term, which transforms like U2 d mu h. But then U2 dagger is equal to U2 inverse, because this is a unitary matrix, so these guys cancel. So it's invariant under U2. And finally, under U1, all that happens is that it's this analogous but simpler argument. This guy picks up a factor of e to the I times 1 half times alpha under a U1 transformation. But then this is just the dagger of that, so this picks up an e to the minus I times 1 half times alpha. So those cancel. So this term is good to go. So now let's look at the fermions. Okay, well, the first thing we want our fermions to do is be invariant under Lorentz transformations, as always. So, but we know, you know, Dirac found out how to write down the expression that is invariant under Lorentz transform, the Lorentz invariant kinetic term for fermions. So that's, we take one fermion, and then we take the Dirac operator, and then we contract it with any other spin one half. We take one spinner and we contract it with another spinner. So these spinners, you know, remember we don't usually show them, or we don't usually show them explicitly, but so psi here has some index. So it transforms like, so this is some four component complex vector, a Dirac spinner. And so this index is just labeling these four components. And then under a Lorentz transformation, this thing doesn't transform like an ordinary vector, it doesn't transform like a scalar, it transforms like a spinner, so it gets hit by the spin one half representation of the Lorentz group. And the point of this expression, this Dirac expression, is that if we take this guy's Lorentz index, we hit it with this guy, which is an operator which carries two Lorentz indices. So let's say beta alpha. Its column index is contracted with here, but its beta is now contracted with psi bar's Lorentz index. So the point about psi bar is that you might think we should just take psi dagger here, but to actually get this, to get a Lorentz invariant object, famously we have to stick in Lorentzian signature, we have to stick in an extra Dirac gamma zero matrix here. But then once we do that, this thing just has a nice lowered index. It picks up, it transforms exactly as the inverse of this representation. So we get if we call this matrix lambda 1 half, then we get this whole bit transforms as lambda to the 1 half, this whole bit transforms as lambda to the minus. Sorry, I said that wrong. Lambda sub 1 half. This guy transforms like lambda sub 1 half. This guy transforms as lambda sub 1 half inverse. So those two lambdas cancel, and this thing is Lorentz invariant. Okay, but so what about making it gauge invariant? So if we contract any two fermions in this way, we'll get something Lorentz invariant. But in general, if we take any two of our fermions on our table and contract them in this way, we won't get a gauge invariant thing. So let's try to make something gauge invariant. So let's suppose we first wrote down, let's just pick a object at random from the table there. Let's suppose we wrote down the Dirac operator acting on U right. Well, the first thing we have learned is that to have any hope of having this thing be build it something gauge invariant, we should replace the partial by the covariant derivative. Okay, so we'll write e to the I capital D slash acting on the spinner U right. Okay, and now let's just to make sure again that we know what we're talking about, let's look at how does d mu acting on U right actually look? Just to make sure again that we're clear on the notation. Well, this would be partial mu, and then, okay, so. Yeah. So again, we're expanding out that top line. But we're plugging in the appropriate representation for each for SU3, SU2, and U1. So in this case, according to the table over there, this guy transforms like a triplet under SU3. So here we have the, so it does transform, in other words, under SU3. So we have the SU3 gauge field in its 3x3 representation appearing here. If you look in the SU2 column, U-right has a 1, so it's trivial. It doesn't transform under SU2, so we have no SU2 gauge field appearing here. But then it has charge plus 2/3, so we have IG1 times 2/3 times B mu, okay, acting on U-right. Okay, so that's what the covariant derivative means there, and then D slash just means we've contracted this with the Dirac gamma matrix. Okay, great. So far so good. So now we have a thing which we've acted with the Dirac operator. So this thing so far has exactly the same indices that this thing did. It used to have a spinner index, but the Dirac operator is, it used to have an up spinner index, but the Dirac operator is constructed so that this thing also has an up spinner index. It used to have an SU3 index, and an SU2 index, a triplet index for SU3 and a doublet index for SU2. And this thing has been constructed to exactly preserve those properties. So this whole thing now carries that same SU3 index and same SU2 index. Okay. So now we need to write down some spinner bar in order to make a gauge invariant thing out of this. So let's try something. Okay, what if we wrote down U right bar? Well, that would be good. So why would that be good? So first of all, we've contracted a spinner with a spinner bar in the usual way, so it's a Lorentz invariant object. But also here, this guy had a SU3 index. This guy also has an SU3 index, which we've daggered. And so just like in GR, if you want to get invariant objects, you have to make sure, you know, in GR you're used to having things running around with indices, and you know, if you have an object like this, W sub alpha V B mu, that's not going to be Lorentz invariant. Similarly, W times V mu is not going to be Lorentz invariant. But if you have something where the lower and upper indices match and you can contract them, okay, then that's a Lorentz invariant thing. And so similarly here, this guy does have an SU3 index. This guy also has an SU3 index. And importantly, it's been complex conjugated so that when this guy, it's been daggered. So this guy picks up a matrix U3, but this guy picks up a matrix U3 dagger, and those U3 daggers kill each other. Similarly, this guy is a doublet, and this guy is also a doublet, but we've taken the dagger. So this guy picks up a U2, and this guy picks up a U2 dagger. They kill each other, and then also under U1, this one picks up an e to the plus I times 2/3. Times alpha, and this guy picks up a minus I 2/3 times alpha, e to the minus I 2/3 times alpha. So those two phases kill each other. So this guy would be invariant. What if we had tried to put something else here? What if we had tried to put D right here? What would go wrong? So D right bar, that would still be Lorentz invariant. It would still be SU3 invariant because the SU3 index on this would get contracted with the lower SU3 index on this. By the way, just like in GR where you have upper indices and lower indices, and there the upper index means that this thing transforms like the fundamental representation of the Lorentz group, whereas this guy transforms with a lambda transpose, or in other words, a lambda inverse. Here it's convenient to think about guys that transform under the fundamental representation of, let's say, SU3 or SUN as having an upper index. And then when you dagger them, those things transform with a lower index because they transform with a U dagger. So this guy has an upper SU3 index. This guy has a lower SU3 index. So far, so good. This object is SU3 invariant. But what about SU2? This guy does have an SU2 index. This guy does not because this guy transforms. If you look in the SU2 column, this guy is a 2. This guy is a 1. So this thing is not SU2 invariant. Moreover, it's not U1 invariant because this guy transforms with charge 2/3. So this would pick up a factor of e to the I 2/3 times alpha, whereas this guy would transform with a factor of e to the I times minus 1/3 times alpha, and then we would take the dagger of all of this. So that would be e to the plus 1/3. So this would all give a factor, an overall factor of e to the I alpha. So it's not invariant under U1 either. Okay, so this term doesn't work. So if you go through every item on the list there and try to write down any fermion here and take its bar, you'll find they all don't work. The only thing that you're allowed to write here by gauge invariance is U right bar. And the same is true for every other fermion in that table. Okay, so the only thing you can write down by Lorentz invariance and gauge invariance on this line is every fermion in the table contracted with its bar. Okay, so that's line 3. The kinetic term for the fermions is U right bar times the appropriate covariant derivative times U right plus, let me leave myself a little room because I'm about to say something else here, U right bar times the appropriate covariant derivative times U right plus, oh sorry, well let me do it in order. So we have Q left bar times the appropriate covariant derivative times Q left, and then plus U right bar times the appropriate covariant derivative times U right, and then plus D right bar times the appropriate covariant derivative for D right times D right, and then, so those are the quark kinetic terms, and then there's the lepton kinetic terms. Okay, now if we were including nu right, which we're not, but we would have a term here for nu right. And then finally, e right bar d slash e right. Okay, so that's line 3. Now, I've left a little gap here. Why? Because, okay, I was a little bit too slick. You might be worried about something, which is that in this table, although I didn't write it here, remember that last time we mentioned that actually each of these guys has another index, which as far as we know, runs from 1 to 3, but has nothing to do with any of these gauge groups. It's just for some unknown reason, all the fermions in this table are copied 3 times. And if you are paying close attention, you might wonder, well, okay, so the argument that I gave before, why couldn't I write down what would be wrong with writing down a contraction of QL from the first generation with QL from the second generation? Wouldn't that also be gauge invariant? And the answer is yes, that would also be gauge invariant. And so in general, I have to add all such combinations. So for QI from the ith generation and QJ from the jth generation, I have to write down that term and include an appropriate coefficient, KIJ. Okay, where KIJ, it would be completely compatible with Lorentz invariance and gauge invariance to take any complex number for KIJ. So what I really have here is a 3x3, I have to write down QI contracted with QJ times a 3x3 complex matrix in the middle. Okay, so this is like some 3x3 complex matrix, and then QI is a row vector, is a column vector that's hitting it from this side, and QI bar is a row vector that's hitting it from this side. Okay, but in this case, what saves us? Well, we have to use the fact that the Lagrangian is Hermitian, so that means whenever we write down a term like this, by itself, this term will not be, in general, Hermitian. So we have to add the dagger of this term. We have to add the Hermitian conjugate of this term. And then, if you think about it, I won't go through this here, but you can, so that when you add this term to its dagger, that's equivalent to saying that you didn't add this term to its dagger, but you could have taken Kij to be a Hermitian matrix from the start. But then if K is a Hermitian matrix, I can diagonalize it with unitaries into a real matrix conjugated by unitaries. And then I can absorb, if I send Q goes to U inverse Q, if I redefine the field Q left like this, I can absorb this U into a redefinition of the fields Q. And then also, actually, if I redefine, if I then also send the new Q, I, to the lambda is a diagonal matrix with real eigenvalues. So the ith one, I can absorb the square root of that eigenvalue into it. The ith field, I can absorb the square root of the into it. And so not only can I, by a redefinition, absorb U, but by a redefinition of the fields, I can absorb lambda. And so conventionally, that is what is done. Okay, so in fact, by appropriately redefining and renormalizing the fields, I can always absorb those guys, the matrix here, and similarly for the matrices that in general would appear here, here, and here. So we will always work in the convention where those matrices have always been absorbed, so all that's left over is the unit matrix, which we don't have to write. Okay, so that's line 3. And, okay, there we go. I started 10 minutes late. I should end now. So we'll get to line 4 tomorrow. Sorry about that. I'm following my pledge. Okay, so we're almost there, and then there'll be time for a small celebration.